15. Revelations. Descent. Scattering. In the 2 days since the War Master's departure, the vengeful spirit had become a ghost ship, the mighty vessel having hemorrhaged landers, carriers, skiffs, and any other craft capable of making it to the surface to follow Horus to Davin. This suited Ignace Carcassi fine, as he marched with newfound purpose and practiced insouciance through the decks of the ship, a canvas satchel slung over one shoulder. Each time he passed a public area of the ship, he would check for anyone watching and liberally spread a number of sheets of paper around on desks, tables, and couches. The ache in his shoulder was lessening, the more copies of The Truth Is All We Have he distributed from the satchel, each sheet bearing three of what he considered to be his most powerful works to date. Uncaring Gods was his personal favorite, unfavorably comparing the Astartes warriors to the ancient titans of myth. A powerful piece that he knew was worthy of a wider audience. He knew he had to be careful with such works, but the passion burned in him too brightly to be contained. He'd managed to get his hands on a cheap bulk printer with ridiculous ease, acquiring one from the first junkyard dog he'd approached with no more than a few moments' effort. It was not a good quality machine, or even one he would have looked twice at on Terra, but even so, it had cost him the bulk of his winnings at Mercy Mercy. It was a poor thing, but it did the job, even though his billet now stank of printer's ink. Humming quietly to himself, Carcassi continued through the civilian decks, coming at last to the retreat, careful now that he was entering areas where he was known, and where there might be others around. His fears were unfounded, as the retreat was empty, making it even more depressing and run-down-looking. One should never see a drinking establishment well-lit, he thought. It just makes it look even sadder. He made his way through the retreat, placing a couple of sheets on each table. Carcassi froze as he heard the clink of a bottle on a glass, his hand outstretched to another table.
"What are you doing?"
asked a cultured but clearly drunk female voice. Carcassi turned and saw a bedraggled woman slumped in one of the booths at the far end of the retreat, where she explained why he hadn't seen her. She was in shadow, but he instantly recognized her as Petronella Vivar, the War Master's documentarist, though her appearance was a far cry from when he had last seen her on Davin. No, that wasn't right, he remembered. He had seen her on the embarkation deck as the Astartes had returned with the War Master. Obviously, the experience hadn't failed to leave its mark on her.
"Those papers," she said. "What are they?"
Carcassi guiltily dropped the sheets he had been holding onto the tabletop and shifted the satchel so that it rested at his back.
"Nothing, really," he said,
moving down the rows of booths towards her.
"Just some poems I'd like people to read." "Poetry? Is it any good? I could use something uplifting."
He knew he should leave her to her maudlin solitude, but the egotist in him couldn't help but respond.
"Yes, I think they're some of my best. Can I read them?" "I wouldn't right now, my dear," he said. "Not if you're looking for something light. They're a bit dark." "A bit dark," she laughed,
the sound harsh and ugly.
"You have no idea." "It's Viva, isn't it?" asked Carcassi, approaching her booth. "That's your name, isn't it?"
She looked up, and Carcassi, an expert in gauging levels of inebriation in others, saw that she was drunk to the point of insensibility. Three bottles sat drained on the table, and a fourth lay in pieces on the floor.
"Yes, that's me. Petronella Vivar," she said. "Palatina Maioria of House Carpinus, writer and fraud. And, I think, very drunk." "I can see that. But what do you mean by fraud?"
"Fraud," she slurred, taking another drink.
"I came here to tell the glory of Horus and the splendid brotherhood of the Primarchs, you know? Told Horus when I met him that if he didn't let me do it, he could go to hell. Thought I'd lost my chance right there and then, but he laughed."
"He laughed?" She nodded.
"Yes, laughed. But he let me do it anyway. Think he might have thought I'd be amusing to keep around or something. I thought I was ready for anything." "And has it proved to be all you hoped it would be, my dear Petronella?"
"No, not really, if I'm honest. Want a drink? I'll tell you about it."
Carcassy nodded and fetched himself a glass from the bar, before sitting across from her. She poured him some wine, getting more on the table than in the glass.
"Thank you," he said. "So, why is it not what you thought it would be? As many a remembrancer would think such a position would be a documentarist's dream. Mercer de Ollerton would have killed to land such a role."
"Who?"
"A friend of mine," explained Carcassy. "She's also a documentarist."
"She wouldn't want it, trust me,"
said Petronella, and Carcassy could see that the puffiness around her eyes was due as much to tears as to alcohol.
"Some illusions are best kept. Everything I thought I knew. Upside down, just like that. Trust me, she doesn't want this."
"Oh, I think she might,"
said Carcassy, taking a drink. She shook her head and took a closer look at him, as though seeing him for the first time.
"Who are you?"
she asked suddenly.
"I don't know you." "My name is Ignace Carcassy," he said, puffing out his chest. "Winner of the Ethiopic Laureate, and..."
"Carcassy? I know that name,"
she said, rubbing the heel of her palm against her temple as she sought to recall him.
"Wait, you're a poet, aren't you?"
"I am indeed," he said. "Do you know my work?"
She nodded.
"You write poetry." "Bad poetry, I think. I don't remember."
Stung by her casual dismissal of his work, he resorted to petulance and said,
"Well, what have you written that's so bloody great? Can't say I remember reading anything you've written."
"Huh. You'll remember what I'm going to write, I'll tell you that for nothing."
"Really?"
quipped Carcassy, gesturing at the empty bottles on the table.
"And what might that be? Memoirs of an inebriated socialite? Vengeful spirits of the vengeful spirit? You think you're so clever, don't you?"
"I have my moments,"
said Carcassy, knowing that there wasn't much challenge in scoring points over a drunken woman, but enjoying it nonetheless. Anyway, it would be pleasant to take this spoiled rich girl, who was complaining about the biggest break of her life, down a peg or two.
"You don't know anything,"
she snapped.
"Don't I?"
he asked.
"Why don't you illuminate me, then?"
"Fine, I will."
And she told Ignace Carcassy the most incredible tale he'd ever heard in his life.
"Why did you bring me here?"
asked Horace, backing away from the silver tank. The eyes on the other side of the glass watched him curiously, clearly aware of him in a way that everyone else they had encountered on this strange odyssey was not. Though he knew with utter certainty who those eyes belonged to, he couldn't accept that this sterile chamber, far beneath the earth, was where the glory of his life had begun. Raised on Chthonia, under the black smog of the smelteries, that had been his home, his earliest memories a blur of confusing images and feelings. Nothing in his memory recalled this place, or the awareness that must have grown within.
"You have seen the ultimate goal of the Emperor, my friend," said Sejanus. "Now it is time for you to see how he began his quest for godhood."
"With the Primarchs," said Horus.
"That makes no sense."
"It makes perfect sense. You were to be his generals, like unto gods. You would bestride planets and claim back the galaxy for him. You were a weapon, Horus, a weapon to be cast aside once blunted and past all usefulness."
Horus turned from Sejanus and marched along the walkway, stopping periodically to peer through the glass of the tanks. He saw something different in each one, light and form indistinguishable, organisms like architecture, eyes and wheels turning in circles of fire. Power like nothing he had known was at work, and he could feel the potent energies surrounding and protecting the tanks, rippling across his skin like waves in the air. He stopped by the tank with 11 stenciled upon it, and placed his hand against the smooth steel, feeling the untapped glories that might have lain ahead for what grew within, but knowing that they would never come to pass. He leaned forward to look within.
"You know what happens here, Horus," said Sejanus. "You are not long for this place."
"Yes," said Horus. "There was an accident. We were lost, scattered across the stars until the Emperor discovered us."
"No," said Sejanus. "There was no accident."
Horus turned from the glass, confused.
"What are you talking about?"
"Of course there was. We were hurled from Terra like leaves in a storm. I came to Chthonia, Russ to Fenris, Sanguinius to Baal, and the others to the worlds they were raised on.
No, you misunderstand me. I meant that it wasn't an accident, said Sejanus. Look around you. You know how far beneath the earth we are, and you saw the protective wards carved on the doors that led here. What manner of accident do you think could reach into this facility and scatter you so far across the galaxy? And what were the chances of you all coming to rest on ancient homeworlds of humanity?
Horus had no answer for him, and leaned on the walkway's railing, taking deep breaths as Sejanus approached him.
What are you suggesting?
I am suggesting nothing. I am telling you what happened.
You are telling me nothing, roared Horus. You fill my head with speculation and conjecture, but you tell me nothing concrete. Maybe I'm being stupid, I don't know. So explain what you mean in plain words.
Very well, nodded Sejanus. I will tell you of your creation.
Thunderheads rumbled over the summit of the Delphos, and Euphrates Keeler snapped off a couple of quick pics of the structure's immensity, silhouetted against sheets of purple lightning. She knew the pics were nothing special, the composition banal and pedestrian, but she took them anyway, knowing that every moment of this historic time had to be recorded for future generations.
Are you done? Asked Titus Kassar, who stood a little way behind her. The prayer meeting's in a few moments, and you don't want to be late.
I know, Titus. Stop fussing.
She had met Titus Kassar the day after she had arrived in the Valley of the Delphos, following the secret Lectitio Divinitatis symbols to a clandestine prayer meeting he had organized in the shadow of the mighty building. She had been surprised by how many people were part of his congregation. Nearly 60 souls, all with their heads bowed and reciting prayers to the divine emperor of mankind. Kassar had welcomed her into his flock, but people had quickly gravitated to her daily prayers and sermons, preferring them to his. For all his faith, Kassar was no orator, and his awkward, spiky delivery left a lot to be desired. He had faith, but he was no iterator, that was for sure. She had worried that he might resent her usurping his group, but he had welcomed it, knowing that he was a follower, not a leader. In truth, she was no leader either. Like Kassar, she had faith, but felt uncomfortable standing in front of large groups of people. The crowds of the faithful didn't seem to notice, staring at her in rapturous adoration as she delivered the word of the emperor.
I'm not fussing, Euphrates.
Yes, you are.
Well, maybe I am, but I have to get back to the Dies Irae before I'm missed. And Princeps Turnit will have my hide if he finds out what I've been doing here.
The mighty war engines of the Legio Mortis stood sentinel over the Warmaster at the mouth of the valley, their bulk too enormous to allow them to enter. The crater looked more like the site of a military muster than a gathering of pilgrims and supplicants. Tanks, trucks, flatbeds and mobile command vehicles having carried tens of thousands of people to this place over the past 7 days. Together with the bizarre-looking locals, a huge portion of the expeditionary fleet filled the crater with makeshift camps all around the Delphos. People had, in a wondrous outpouring of spontaneous feeling, made their way to where the Warmaster lay, and the scale of it still had the power to take Euphrates' breath away. The steps of the temple were thick with offerings to the Warmaster, and she knew that many of the people here had given all they had in the hope that it might speed his recovery in some way. Keela had a new passion in her life, but she was still an imagist at heart, and some of the pics she had taken here were amongst her finest work.
Yes, you're right, we should go, she said,
folding up her picture and hanging it around her neck. She ran her hand through her hair, still not used to how short it was now, but liking how it made her feel.
Have you thought about what you're going to say tonight?
Asked Kassar, as they made their way through the thronged sight of the prayer meeting.
No, not really, she answered.
I never planned that far ahead. I just let the Emperor's light fill me, and then I speak from the heart.
Kassar nodded, hanging on her every word. She smiled.
You know, 6 months ago, I'd have laughed if anyone had said things like that around me.
What things?
Asked Kassar.
About the Emperor, she said,
fingering the silver eagle on a chain she kept tucked beneath her remembrance's robes.
But I guess a lot can happen to a person in that time.
I guess so, agreed Kassar,
making way for a group of army soldiers.
The Emperor's light is a powerful force, Euphrates.
As Keela and Kassar drew level with the soldiers, a thick-necked bull of a man with a shaved head slammed his shoulder into Kassar and pitched him to the ground.
"Hey, watch where you're going,"
snarled the soldier, looming over Kassar. Keela stood over the fallen Kassar and shouted, "Piss off, you cretin! You hit him!" The soldier turned, backhanding his fist into Euphrates' jaw, and she dropped to the ground, more shocked than hurt. She struggled to rise as blood filled her mouth, but a pair of hands gripped her shoulders and held her firm to the ground. Two soldiers held her down as the others started kicking the fallen Kassar.
"Get off me!" she yelled.
"Shut up, bitch!"
said the first soldier.
"You think we don't know what you're doing? Prayers and stuff to the Emperor! Horus is the one you should be giving thanks to!"
Kassar rolled to his knees, blocking the kicks as best he could. But he was facing three trained soldiers and couldn't block them all. He punched one in the groin and swayed away from a thick-soled boot aimed at his head, finally gaining his feet as a chopping hand struck him on the side of the neck. Keela struggled in her captor's grip, but they were too strong. One man reached down to tear the picta from around her neck, and she bit his wrist as it came into range of her teeth. He yelped and ripped the picta from her as the other wrenched her head back by the roots of her hair.
"Don't you dare!"
she screamed, struggling even harder as the soldier swung the picta by its strap and smashed it to pieces on the ground. Kassar was down on one knee, his face bloody and angry. He freed his pistol from its holster, but a knee connected with his face and knocked him insensible, the pistol clattering to the ground beside him.
"Titus!"
shouted Keela, fighting like a wildcat and finally managing to free one arm. She reached back and clawed her nails down the face of the man who held her. He screamed and released his grip on her, and she scrambled on her knees to the fallen pistol.
"Get her!"
someone shouted.
"Emperor-loving witch!"
She reached the pistol, hearing the thud of heavy impacts, and rolled onto her back. She held the gun out in front of her, ready to kill the next bastard that came near her. Then she saw that she wouldn't have to kill anyone. Three of the soldiers were down. One was running for his life through the campsite, and the last was held in the iron grip of an Astartes warrior. The soldier's feet flailed a meter off the ground as the Astartes held him round the neck with one hand.
5-1 doesn't seem very sporting now, does it?"
asked the warrior, and Keela saw it was Captain Torgadon, one of the Mournival. She remembered snapping some fine images of Torgadon on the vengeful spirit and thinking that he was the handsomest of the sons of Horus. Torgadon ripped the name and unit badge from the struggling soldier's uniform before dropping him and saying,
"You'll be hearing from the Discipline Masters. Now get out of my sight before I kill you."
Keela dropped the pistol and scooted over to her picta, cursing as she saw that it and the images contained within it were probably ruined. She pawed through the remains and lifted out the memory coil. If she could get this into the edit engine she kept in her billet quickly enough, then perhaps she could save some of the images. Kassar groaned in pain, and she felt a momentary pang of guilt that she'd gone for her smashed picta before him, but it soon passed.
"Are you Keela?"
asked Torgadon, as she slipped the memory coil into her robes. She looked up, surprised that he knew her name, and said,
"Yes."
"Good,"
he said, offering his hand to help her to her feet.
"You want to tell me what that was all about?"
he asked. She hesitated, not wanting to tell an Astartes warrior the real reason for the assault.
"I don't think they like the images I was taking," she said.
"Everyone's a critic, eh?"
chuckled Torgadon, but she could see that he didn't believe her.
"Yeah, but I need to get back to the ship to recover them."
"Well, that's a happy coincidence," said Torgadon.
"What do you mean?"
"I've been asked to take you back to the Vengeful Spirit."
"You have? Why?"
"Does it matter?" asked Torgadon. "You're coming back with me."
"You can at least tell me who wants me back, can't you?"
"No. It's top secret."
"Really?"
"No, not really. It's Kirill Sinderman."
The idea of Sinderman sending an Astartes warrior to do his bidding seemed ludicrous to Keela, and there could be only one reason why the venerable iterator wanted to speak to her. Ignace or Mercedy must have blabbed to him about her new faith, and she felt her anger grow at their unwillingness to understand her newfound truth.
"So the Astartes are at the beck and call of the iterators now," she snapped.
"Hardly," said Torgadon. "It's a favour to a friend, and I think it might be in your own best interests to go back."
"Why?"
"You ask a lot of questions, Miss Keela," said Torgadon, "and while that's a trait that probably stands you in good stead as a remembrancer, it might be best for you to be quiet and listen for a change."
Am I in trouble? Togaden stirred the smashed remnants of her picture with his boot and said, Let's just say that someone wants to give you some lessons in pictography.
The Emperor knew he would need the greatest warriors to lead his armies, began Sejanus. To lead such warriors as the Astartes needed commanders like gods, commanders who were virtually indestructible and could command superhuman warriors in the blink of an eye. They would be engineered to be leaders of men, mighty warlords whose martial prowess was only matched by the Emperor's, each with his own particular skills, the Primarchs. Indeed, only beings of such magnitude could even think of conquering the galaxy. Can you imagine the hubris and will required even to contemplate such an endeavor? What manner of man could even consider it? Who but a Primarch could be trusted with such a monumental task? No man, not even the Emperor, could achieve such a godlike undertaking alone. Hence, you were created. To conquer the galaxy for humanity, said Horus. No, not for humanity. For the Emperor, said Sejanus. You already know in your heart what awaits you when the Great Crusade is over. You will become a jailer who polices the Emperor's regime while he ascends to godhood and abandons you all. What sort of reward is that for someone who conquered the galaxy?
It is no reward at all, snarled Horus, hammering his hand into the side of the silver tank before him. The metal buckled, and a hairline crack split the toughened glass under his assault. He could hear a desperate drumming from inside, and a hiss of escaping gas whined from the frosted panel of the tank.
Look around you, Horus, said Sejanus. Do you think that the science of man alone could have created a being such as a Primarch? If such technology existed, why not create 100 Horuses, 1,000? No. A bargain was made that saw you emerge from its forging. I know. For the masters of the warp are as much your father as the Emperor.
No! Shouted Horus. I won't believe you. The Primarchs are my brothers. The Emperor's sons created from his own flesh and blood, and each a part of him.
Each a part of him, yes. But where did such power come from? He bargained with the gods of the warp for a measure of their power. That is what he invested in you, not his paltry human power.
The gods of the warp? What are you talking about, Sejanus?
The entities whose realm is being destroyed by the Emperor, said Sejanus. Intelligences, Xenos creatures, gods. Does it matter what terminology we use for them? They have such incredible power that they might as well be gods by your reckoning. They command the secrets of life and death and all that lies between. Experience, change, war and decay, they are all part of the endless cycle of existence, and the gods of the warp hold dominion over them all. Their power flows through your veins and bestows incredible abilities upon you. The Emperor has long known of them, and he came to them many centuries ago, offering friendship and devotion.
He would never do such a thing, denied Horus.
You underestimate his lust for power, my friend,
said Sejanus, as they made their way back towards the steps that led down to the laboratory floor.
The gods of the warp are powerful, but they do not understand this material universe, and the Emperor was able to betray them, stealing away their power for himself. In creating you, he passed on but a tiny measure of that power.
Horus felt his breath come in short, painful bursts. He wanted to deny Sejanus's words, but part of him knew that this was no lie. Like any man, his future was uncertain, but his past had always been his own. His glories and life had been forged with his own two hands, but even now they were being stripped away from him by the Emperor's treachery.
So, we are tainted, whispered Horus. All of us. Tainted, no, said Sejanus, shaking his head. The power of the warp simply is. Used wisely, and by a man of power, it can be a weapon like no other. It can be mastered, and it can be a powerful tool for one with the will to use it.
Then why did the Emperor not use it well?
Because he was weak, said Sejanus, leaning in close to Horus. Unlike you, he lacked the will to master it, and the gods of the warp do not take kindly to those who betray them. The Emperor had taken a measure of their power for himself, but they struck back at him.
How?
You will see. With the power he stole from them, he was too powerful for them to attack directly. But they had foreseen a measure of his plans, and they struck at what he needed most to realize those plans.
The Primarchs.
The Primarchs,
agreed Sejanus, walking back down the length of walkway. Horus heard distant sirens blare, and felt the air within the chamber become more agitated, as if a cold electric current whipped from molecule to molecule. What's going on? He asked, as the sirens grew louder.
Justice, said Sejanus.
The reflective surfaces of the tanks lit up as an actinic blue light appeared above them, and Horus looked up to see a blob of dirty light swirling into existence just below the ceiling. Like a miniature galaxy, it hung suspended above the silver incubation tanks, growing larger with every passing second. A powerful wind tugged at Horus, and he hung onto the railing as a shrieking howl issued from the spreading vortex above him.
What is that?
He shouted, working his way along the railing towards the stairs.
You know what it is, Horus, said Sejanus. We have to get out of here. It's too late for that, said Sejanus, taking his arm in an iron grip. Take your hand off me, Sejanus, warned Horus, or whatever your name is. I know you're not Sejanus, so you might as well stop pretending.
Even as he spoke, he saw a group of armored warriors rushing through the chamber's doorway towards them. There were six of them, each with the build of an Astartes, but without a suit of battle plate, they were less bulked out and gigantic. They wore fabulously ornate gold breastplates, decorated with eagles and lightning bolts, and each wore a tall peaked helm of bronze with a red horsehair plume. Scarlet cloaks billowed behind them in the cyclone that swept through the chamber. Long spears with bolt guns slung beneath long, crackling blades were aimed at him, and he instantly recognized the warriors for what they were. The custodian guard, the praetorians of the Emperor himself.
Halt, fiends, and face thy judgment!
Shouted the lead warrior, aiming his guardian spear at Horus's heart. Though the warrior wore an enclosing helm, Horus would have recognized his eyes and that voice anywhere.
Valdor! Cried Horus. Constantin Valdor! It's me! It's Horus!
Be silent! Shouted Valdor. End this foul conjuration now!
Horus looked up at the ceiling, feeling the power contained within that swirling maelstrom tugging at him, like the call of a long-lost friend. He forced its siren song from his mind, dropped to the floor of the chamber, and took a step forward. Ripping blasts of light erupted from the custodian's spears, and Horus was forced to his knees by the hammering impacts of their shells. The howling gale swallowed the noise of the shots, and Horus cried out, not with pain, but with the knowledge that fellow warriors of the Imperium had fired upon him. More blasts struck him, tearing great chunks from his armor, but none was able to defeat its protection. The custodians advanced in disciplined ranks, pouring their fire into him and keeping him pinned beneath its weight. Sejanus ducked behind the stairs, sparks and smoking chunks ripping from the metal as the explosive bolts tore through it. Horus roared in anger and surged to his feet, all thoughts of restraint forgotten as he found himself at the center of the deafening storm. A bolt clipped his gorget and almost spun him around, but it was not enough to stop him. He ripped the guardian spear from the nearest custodian and smashed his skull to splinters with a single blow from his fist. He reversed his grip on the spear and slashed the next custodian from collarbone to groin, the two shorn halves swept up by the howling winds and vanishing into the crackling vortex. Another custodian died as Horus rammed the spear through his chest and split him in two. A blade lanced for his head, but he shattered it with a swipe of his fist and ripped the arm from his attacker with casual ease. Another custodian died as Horus tore his head off in his mighty fist, blood gushing from the neck as if from a geyser, as he tossed the severed head aside. Only Valdor remained, and Horus snarled as he rounded on the chief custodian. A blaze of light erupted from the barrel of Valdor's guardian spear. Horus grunted at the impacts and raised his fist to strike Valdor down, hearing metal squeal and tear as the force of the hurricane reaching from the vortex above finally achieved its goal. Horus paused in his attack, suddenly terrified for the fate of those inside the tanks. He turned and saw one tank spewing gases and screams as it was ripped from the ground, following others as they were torn from their moorings and swept upwards. Then time stopped, and a blinding light filled the chamber. Horus felt warm honey flow through him, and he turned towards the source of the light. A shimmering golden giant of unimaginable majesty and beauty. Horus dropped to his knees in rapture at the sight. Who would not strive to worship so perfect a being? Power and certainty flowed from the figure, the secret mystery of creation at his fingertips, the answers to any question that could be asked there for the knowing, and the wisdom to know how to use them. He wore armor that gleamed a perfect gold, his features impossible to know, and his glory and power unmatched by any being in creation. The golden warrior moved as though in slow motion, raising his hand to halt the madness of the vortex with a gesture. The maelstrom was silenced, the tumbling incubation tanks suspended in mid-air. The golden figure turned a puzzled gaze upon Horus.
"I know you,"
he said, and Horus wept to hear such a perfect symphony of sound.
"Yes,"
said Horus, unable to raise his voice above a whisper. The giant cocked his head to one side and said,
"You would destroy my great works, but you will not succeed. I beg you, turn from this path, or all will be lost."
Horus reached out towards the golden warrior as he turned his sad gaze to the incubation tanks held motionless above him, weighing the consequences of future events in the blink of an eye. Horus could see the decision in the figure's wondrous eyes and shouted, "No!" The figure turned from him, and time snapped back into its prescribed stream. The deafening howl of the warp-spawned wind returned with the force of a hurricane, and Horus heard the screams of his brothers amid the metallic clanging of their incubation tanks.
"Father, no!"
he yelled.
"You can't let this happen!"
The golden giant was walking away, leaving the carnage in his wake, uncaring of the lives he had wrought. Horus felt his hate swell bright and strong within his breast. The power of the wind seized him in its grip, and he let it take him, spinning him up into the air, and Horus opened his arms as he was reunited once again with his brothers. The abyss of the warp vortex yawned above him like a great eye of terror and madness. He surrendered to its power and let it take him into its embrace.